Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. This episode explores a crucial chapter in Middle Eastern history as we delve into the British Mandate in Palestine, a period marked by the emergence of nationalist movements and uprising from both Arab and Jewish communities. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, join us for a timely examination of how the British administration in post-Ottoman Palestine still resonates today.
Well, this then gains some traction. He, if you've seen the movie Lawrence of Arabia, you don't really see him, but you see his son, played by Obi-Wan Kenobi, Sir Alec Guinness, as Prince Faisal. But what happens, though, is this fermentation of an Arab consciousness that there is going to be something for them if they are successful. Sharif Hussein made the case for an Arab kingdom and for the British support as the quid pro quo. And part of the problem is the ambiguity of the agreement that occurred when there were 10 letters that went back and forth between MacMahon and Hussein from about August of 1915 to March of 1916. When those letters were finally concluded, what we find then is the British promised to support an Arab kingdom in that area. What the details were was still left as an open-ended question. 6 weeks later, the Sykes-Picot Agreement is made, which of course makes one think, did the Sykes-Picot Agreement just simply come about later? Or as what most people would cynically agree, that this was something that the British were and the French were already planning on how to carve up the Middle East, which so happened to be the same territory that included a lot of what was promised to Sharif Hussein. The following year, the Balfour Declaration then also addresses a part of the territory which ostensibly would have been, at least in Sharif Hussein's mind, part of that Arab kingdom. So you have multiple pledges, multiple promises, same piece of territory.
And so then what happens then? If you've got all these multiple, you've got this, all these promises, we've got to 1919, 1920, 1921, we're around this particular period. The revolt has happened. The Ottomans have been defeated. It's the end of the caliphate. British and French mandates are in place.
Well, now people are looking to collect on the promises. They show up for the British, they show up to the French and say, hey, we went ahead and did what you wanted us to do. We successfully drove the Ottoman forces out of here. By December of 1917, Lord Allenby, or General Allenby at the time, has reached Jerusalem. They've taken Damascus as well. And yet, when it comes to then the details of saying, here, I'm handing over the title to the car or to the house, that does not occur. For the Jewish community, there was certainly a very closer relationship, particularly among the Zionist British establishment, to the British government. Hence, we see the case of Herbert Samuel being appointed. For the Arab community, there was not that same kind of a relationship. And mind you, in 1919, there was a suspicion among even leaders in the British Zionist community, as well as in the Arab community, that the British could not necessarily be trusted. Chaim Weizmann, who was one of the leaders of the British Zionist community from Manchester, had been a very important figure because he had produced, he was a chemist, a way to develop industrial caliber acetone to clean the munitions of the weapons. And as a result, there was quite a bit of gratitude and appreciation from the British government for him. But he met with Sharif Hussein's son, Faisal. Both of them show up at the Paris Peace Conference, and they made a side agreement as to how the region should be governed, because they were dreadfully afraid that there was going to be a mandate. Unfortunately, that didn't come to pass. In May of 1920, Faisal just got fed up, and he then goes ahead and appoints himself to be king in Damascus. And you have to remember that at this area, this whole territory, which today would be Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Palestine, Israel, and part of Iraq, was known as Syria.
Or Greater Syria.
The Greater Syria. And he then goes ahead and appoints himself on the throne. Well, the French had a different idea. And in one single day of combat, they wipe out the Arab army at the Battle of Maizaloon. They very ignominiously get rid of Faisal, and they take over the area. The British, as a consolation prize, install Faisal as the king of an area in Mesopotamia that is formerly three Ottoman provinces of Basra, Baghdad, and Mosul, and this becomes Iraq. But for the Jewish community that now is seeking to develop a national homeland in Palestine, that fervor of nationalism had already been crystallized and defined as Zionism.
Yeah. Now, and in terms of obviously from the 20s onwards, then you're right. So Iraq suddenly appears. So at the time, Sharif Hussein and all, they're expecting to take over the Ottoman Empire, or at least significant chunks of the Ottoman Empire in Fertile Crescent downwards.
That's correct.
But that doesn't happen. And for the first time, we have the creation of countries which really have never existed up to that point.
We have countries, but not sovereign states.
Yeah.
And I think that's an important distinction to make.
So but geographical entities as well, that were never self-defining as they suddenly become. You know, Iraq is new.
Yeah.
Syria is new. Lebanon is totally new.
This is a very important point, because as the title of our talk, What Are the Legacies? These borders then create artificial boundaries in people's consciousness and subconsciousness, especially when it comes to identity. The word Iraq as a national identity never existed before. The word Syria had, as you said, a far broader abstraction. The word Jordan or Urdun didn't really exist either when it comes to a kind of a national
Well, actually, even
identity.
The first country is not even Jordan. It's Transjordan.
It's Transjordan, which was part of the British Mandate of Palestine. That which is across the Jordan River from Palestine. So when we have the Jordan River and the area to the Mediterranean, interestingly enough, according to the Sykes-Picot Agreement, that wasn't even going to be assigned to anyone in 1916. It was going to be what was known in the legal language as an international condominium. That changes after 1919, when the British decide to absorb it in order to then be able to make good on the Balfour Declaration. Yeah.
So these countries are created.
Yeah.
And as well, it's not just it's carved up, but there's a difference between what France does and a difference between what Britain does, isn't there, in terms of once they create these countries. For example, Faisal becomes the king of Iraq, as you said, and Sharif Hussein ends up becoming the king of Jordan.
No, actually...
Not Hussein, sorry, Abdullah, sorry.
It's Abdullah.
Abdullah, sorry, yeah. Abdullah becomes the king of... Abdullah becomes the king of Jordan, or Transjordan. And then Saudi Arabia comes. And so you're in the state of this kind of... to some people, it may look like chaos, but actually what's happening is the creation of the world we live in today is happening in this period in the mid-20s.
I mean, it's as though... You can almost think of drawing lines on a piece of paper, and then you are making up rules. It's almost like you're creating your own board game, except that the people who are making the board game are sitting in London and they're sitting in Paris, but the pieces that they're moving are in the Middle East itself. And if you look on the map of the Middle East, you will come across a certain confusion, because you will see borders that don't make intuitive sense. Usually borders are defined by natural boundaries like rivers or seas or mountain ranges or so. Or in the United States, you'll see these big, ugly, rectangular states out west. And those are, of course, because of latitudinal and longitudinal lines. Or you'll see zigzag lines. But if you see the border between, for example, Iraq and Jordan, it is about a 10-degree slant. A perfectly straight line. And then you have other lines which are perfectly straight, 45 degrees. These do not exist in nature. And you find that these were designed and determined by cartographers sitting, again, in European capitals with no concern about how this was going to be disruptive on the ground, or to be even more cynical, designed particularly to create that kind of chaos and confusion in the identity politics of people. It split not only communities in half, but it also split migration patterns that had been there for generations of nomadic peoples. And everything then is in motion. Despite the fact, as you said, the British then go ahead as a consolation prize, put in Faisal into Iraq. They put Abdullah into Transjordan, which in 1922 then split the British mandate. And then Sharif Hussein, who got the ball rolling for the British and the French to kick out the Ottomans, we find that the British now realize that maybe he's become a liability, particularly to his own people. In 1924, after the Turkish parliament, abolished the caliphate, Sharif Hussein said, well, I should be the new caliph. Except he had now become really discredited among the Muslim community for actually rising up against the old caliphate. And a new presence came in the region, one with whom the British felt much more comfort and confidence. This would be Abdulaziz Al Saud, who was a tribesman, a warrior, a chieftain in the center of Arabia. And when he makes a raid for Mecca and Medina on the west, the British pull their support from Sharif Hussein, transfer it to Abdulaziz Al Saud, and they tell Sharif Hussein, you've had a good run at this. Why don't you just go live with one of your sons, either in Jordan or in Iraq?
And you kind of like described it quite nicely as a raid, but it was actually the Ikhwan. This is actually quite brutal. These are quite brutal attacks, aren't they, from what became modern-day Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, I was using typical British understatement.
Understatement, yeah. And so effectively what we have then are the creation of these countries. And then so I suppose between 1923, 24, 26 to the start of the First World War, the British and the French are still there. Well, Second World War, I should say, not First World War. Second World War, they're still there. What happens in that period then?
So what you find is part of it is the style of governance. For the French, it was very much direct control. For them, security was just everything, and they wanted all of the local people to know that they were in charge. The way that they had designed Syria and carved it up into regions is in the northwest, there was a region around Latakia. And this was a stronghold of a group, a sort of a minority of Muslims known as the Alawi Shia. So they're a minority within the Shia community, and the Shia are a minority writ large in the Muslim community. In the south, there are a much more frontier-based group known as the Druze, who are also Muslim. But the major urban areas are around Damascus and Aleppo. And these are the strongholds, majority-wise, of the Sunni community. But the way that the French ruled it was to purposefully create tensions among these various groups. And so they then had a justification to stay and, in fact, clamp down. Lebanon had been its own separate enclave since about 1860. And I know later on, you're going to be next week in conversation with Eugene Rogan from the University of Oxford, who's got a new book on the 1860 massacre in Damascus, which is a really pivotal moment. Because what it then allows the French to do is come in and demand from the Ottoman Empire that the Ottoman Empire carve out an area to protect the Christian community there. So this encroachment of sovereignty goes all the way back to 1816. And as they say in The Godfather, the French gave the Ottomans an offer they couldn't refuse. So you have that going on over there. For the British, on the other hand, they are having to contend with a dilemma of their own creation. It's very important to remember that prior to all of this, Jewish, Christian, and Muslim communities lived really harmoniously in the area of Palestine and in Jordan. And in fact, you also had migration from outside the region that was authorized by the Ottomans. From 1882 was a watershed year in Russia because you had a major pogrom or persecution program against the Jewish community there. They were scapegoated for a lot of issues that concerned the monarchy. Abdulhamid II, who was the Sultan Caliph at the time in the Ottoman Empire, authorized 35,000 Jews from Eastern Europe and Russia to migrate into Palestine. This was the first, what was known as an aliyah or wave of migration. From 1904 to 1914, so right before World War I, he authorized another 40,000 to come there. These were Ashkenazi Jews, these were European Jews, but living in the region already were what were known as Mizrahi or Syrian Jews. The Sephardic Jews who came over as refugees from Spain, many having been rescued after 1492 by Sultan Bayezid II, who sent ships for them, they settled in Salonika, which today is Thessaloniki in Greece, in Istanbul, and in Izmir, port city on the Aegean. And in fact, at the turn of the 20th century, there were 227,000 Sephardic Jews who constituted 35% of the population of Salonika, 25% of the population of Istanbul, and 20% of the population of Izmir. But more importantly, they didn't migrate to Palestine. Even after Balfour and the establishment of the Mandate, because Salonika, Istanbul, Izmir were urban areas more sophisticated, they were already well settled over there, and because they didn't necessarily see eye to eye and vice versa with the Ashkenazi Jewish community.
They were Arabs. I mean, in the sense that actually the producer who works for me in Israel is a descendant of exactly that, you know, Urfa, Aleppo. Well, Turkey to Aleppo to Lebanon to Israel, family of Arabs with Arab names and Arab looking things. So in that sense, I suppose that's why they didn't have very little connection. So obviously we've got all this stuff going on between the Mandate and the Second World War. We've got all of this, you know, the British trying to find a way of dealing with a situation that's of creation of their own, you may argue. But of course, as you really rightly point out, which lots of people gloss over, it's the Ottomans who first start to allow Zionism into the Middle East, into Palestine, in that area. But of course, once the Second World War starts, then the situation is very different, because obviously France and Britain are in war, but France is also occupied. So that has huge impact on the regions and the countries that they're controlling or have this mandate relationship with.
Well, in 1936 in France, you had the election of a socialist, Léon Blum. And Blum's political party had a completely different perspective when it came to the mandates, and in fact was looking to pull the French out and was preparing for that. Unfortunately, Blum's tenure was short-lived. He was only there for 3 years, and in 1939, when he was voted out, the status quo ante went back in. But when World War II began, you also had, of course, the occupation of France by the Nazis, the establishment of the Vichy regime. And the Vichy regime then doubles down in Syria, Lebanon, because it's now opened up a new front for the Germans against the British interests that are there. So now the British are very worried about what's going to be the future of their mandate over there.
Mm. And it's an interesting place. Obviously, if you go to, there's a place called, there's lots of things which don't work, right? Lebanon in itself is a complete basket case in that sense. You're creating a country which is just too small for the amount, for the diversity of people living in it. But of course, even when you go to Hatay, which is an Arab city in Turkey, because it was a French protectorate, not part of Syria or Lebanon, it's a French protectorate. And so the Second World War starts and Turkey say, yeah, we'll have that bit, thank you very much. And they send their army in. And to this day, if you go to Hatay, like I have done, you're in Turkey, but you're actually speaking Arabic because they're all Arabs. What happens then during the Second World War and take us after that? Because this is the end, really, of the mandate.
That's right. So what ends up happening is there is, for some, a sense of loyalism to fight with the British in the British Mandate of Palestine, thinking that, of course, Germany would be much worse, if not out of a sense of more brutality or suppression, but having to get used to a new system. And it's interesting how people will sometimes reinforce the system in which they're in because they're more scared and fearful of the unpredictability of something that's unknown as opposed to the known known. You have resistance movements that develop on both sides of the communities in Palestine. You have among the Arabs, led by Grand Mufti Haji al-Husseini, actual contact with Berlin, saying that the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and my biggest concern is getting the British out of here so that there can be Arab self-determination.
Just as you had pure occupied, you will have, or in your eyes, you're seen as being occupied, you will have a conversation with the person that your occupier is having a war with.
Ali Maher in Egypt, you had a similar situation happening with the February 4th incident in Iraq. So this was an opportunity for them to seek a change in what was going on. You also, though, had Jewish resistance movements developing. You had the Haganah, you had the Irgun, you had the Lehi, also known as the Stern Gang, that were developing. Because as was happening in places like India and elsewhere in the colonial projects, there was a moment that the war was going to end and it was going to then yield one of a few different outcomes. Either the colonial powers were going to lose, and if they were going to lose, there was going to be now the occupation by the Axis powers, Germany, Italy, and Japan, or the Allies were going to win and they were going to maintain the status quo, or the Allies were going to win and maybe we were going to have the opportunity for independence or self-determination, even though that was not on the books according to the Allies. So these were now preparations that were occurring in two different dimensions. One was a post-war reality to get rid of the mandate altogether. And then, in the case of the British Mandate of Palestine, with the mandatory power out of the way, who was going to control this piece of territory?
So an exhausted Britain.
Yes.
Defeated is not the right word, because obviously France is liberated from occupation, but it's a defeated nation in that sense, because it was occupied. And now a victorious America. And let's not forget, a victorious Soviet Union and an independent but very successful Turkey during this period. We come out of the Second World War, and Britain, I suppose, and France have to, I suppose, find a way of getting out of what they at this point now see as a kind of the burden of the mandate. How does that work out?
In some ways, for the French, it worked out a little bit more easily, because they hadn't promised everything to everyone the way that the British had. And so they simply walked away. And they also didn't have too much guilt in the fact that they left a situation, particularly in Syria, where they never allowed the local population to get any kind of practical training on how to govern. Yes, the mandate was about exactly that, but the French ruled everything directly. So Syria then was in shambles, getting into a series of political coups after it. Lebanon was a little bit different, because the French paid more attention there with the Christian minority. But the Christian community and the Muslim community had already figured things out and found a modus vivendi, such that without a constitution, without anything written down, the two communities then agreed upon that the president was going to be a Christian, but then the president had the power to appoint a prime minister, and he appointed a Muslim to be prime minister.
Well, it's even more, isn't it? I think it's a Sunni. The speaker is a Sunni.
The prime minister is a Sunni.
The speaker is a Shia.
Which happened after the Lebanese civil war.
Yeah,
but not in
not initially.
Not initially at World War II. For the British. In Palestine, of course, this was going to be a mess, because for the Arabs, they had now become very frustrated, going all the way back to World War I, feeling as though they had been betrayed, feeling as though they had been deprived. And you have, of course, because of the Holocaust now, an added level of trauma and an insistence on making good on the Balfour Declaration promise and establishing a homeland. Remember, Balfour never said anything about a sovereign, independent Jewish state. And the Hossein MacMahon correspondence never said anything about a sovereign, independent Arab kingdom either.
So but as we get towards the late 40s and into the 50s, we have the creation of the modern countries that we now consider to be the Middle East, out of the Mandate period and the Ottoman Empire. And I suppose it's fair to say, you know, I once wrote a commentary on this, which in a documentary series, which was, it's a gallery of failed states, you know, rogue gallery of failed states. Not all of them, but a lot of them, you know, Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Palestine, you could go on. Because of the mandate, do you think it's fair to say that the mandate is the reason why we have the kind of like the lack of democracy in any of these countries? Because whether it's the Ba'ath Party in Syria, and in Iraq, or if it's kings in Jordan and Saudi Arabia, and if it's whoever is in control of Egypt, you know, the army, obviously. But we've never really seen any kind of democracy in any of those countries. And is that really the mandate's fault, or ultimately is it because these countries are really new?
I think it's one of the reasons. First of all, I would probably not say that they're failed states. I would say that they were set up for failure states. I think that would probably be a bit more accurate.
Be more fair, I suppose, yeah.
The mandates end not just coinciding with the end of World War II, but with the beginning of the Cold War. And I think that for that reason, it would be unfair to put all the blame on the mandate. Circumstances, as they then develop, necessitated for big powers to not have the volatility and the uncertainty and the unpredictability of democracy kicking in. With the strategic value of oil, with the strategic value of the Suez Canal, it was going to be too much of a risk. Look at what happened in 1953 in Iran with the ouster of Mossadegh. He comes in 1951, he nationalizes the oil industry, upset Churchill to no end, in large part not only because it was now going to cut Britain off from an oil revenue, but also could it then serve as a domino effect as well. So that then leads the CIA and the MI6 to overthrow Mossadegh and restore the Shah to full despotism, if you will. 56, Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal, and you see then that the British and the French urge or encourage, by sending false information and intelligence, that Nasser was going to then attack Israel, have Israel invade, cross the Sinai, retake the Suez Canal. And the French and the British said, we have your back. Eisenhower in the United States said, no, you won't. And this not only then is the end of that campaign, in many ways, it's the end of the British Empire.
It's the end of it, exactly. Yeah. So if we fast forward to, as I think we need to obviously ask some questions as well, if we fast forward to where we are now, so if you look at the countries in the mandate, we have a civil war has happened in some form or other, or war has happened in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon. We have the chaos that is in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. We have Saudi Arabia, which has had, people have had issues with some of the kind of politics of Saudi Arabia in the past and today. We have a resurgent, you know, Turkey and Erdogan and all these things going on there. And I mean, would you say that actually these countries are in a good space now? And what would you, expect them to, what would, if you had a little crystal ball, where would you see them be in the next few years?
Oh my goodness. So I'm going to go ahead, if you don't mind, I'm going to keep Saudi Arabia out of this because it was never occupied.
It never really occupied at all, but yeah.
And I'm going to keep Turkey out of it because Turkey, after World War I, made the decision to stay neutral during World War II. So it, apart from like some of the things that were happening in Syria more recently, has been doing its own thing. But if you look at that old area that you very aptly reminded me was called Greater Syria, if you take a look at just those countries, Lebanon, civil war, Syria, I mean, chaos, Israel, Palestine, certainly, Jordan doesn't have the luxury to even shift in its chair because it's in such a precarious position. And then, of course, you see what happened with Iraq. I would say that it may be more helpful to go back to looking at that whole area without the lines and the sovereignties that now exist, and to think of this whole area having a series of civil wars. It's just one big area. So not thinking of the country of, or the nation state of Israel, the nation state of Jordan, the nation state of Lebanon, and all of these things, sort of post-United Nations entities. And if you look at it that way, then it makes perfect sense that the mandate was really a terrible thing because of what it has wrought, which also then makes us wonder that if you're asking about the crystal ball, how much these countries are going to have to accept the status quo. I mean, these countries still use flags that Lord Sykes, who was part of the Sykes-Picot Agreement, designed for them. And yet they can't really break free of that and think that there's something different that they can do. Now that the Cold War is over, we have to wonder what's the next geopolitics that's going to affect this. And with the rise of the rest, we already see that happening. China with substantial investment in the area. Russia, for the first time in modern Middle Eastern history, physically present in Syria with Air Force and naval bases.
Well, the naval base is interesting because they finally have that access to the warm water.
Ironic, isn't it?
So the whole war in Syria, which the public never really talk about, is give the Russians a 100-year lease on that base, and that's what's happened now, and then suddenly everyone's happy again.
Yeah. So I would say that as we're looking forward, it's probably going to be interesting to see what's going to be Western attitudes toward the Middle East. Is it going to withdraw from some of the penetration that it had before? Will these other powers come in, like Russia, like China, like India? India actually owning the port at Haifa with a substantial investment in Israel. With that, though, we have to wonder that for the next 100 years, is the great game not ending, but simply taking on a new version?
A new version, yeah. Well, I think we could go on and on talking about this for a long time, to be honest with you, but if we can put the lights on, I think, because otherwise we're not going to be able to see anybody's hands. We've got about 10 minutes or so for any kind of questions. I really am saying I can't see anything. Yeah. So
we have the house lights.
If we can put the house lights on, then I can see where anybody's hands are. And I think we have colleagues who have got microphones. Ah, that's fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you. So who would like to ask a question, if you can put your hand up?
Oh, and it's wonderful to see you.
Yeah. He thought we were talking to ourselves for the last 50 minutes. Any questions? Anybody? Oh, there you go.
How much do you think the games that the British played to produce this mandate and keep an iron hold in this region was to actually protect their crown in the jewel, which was India, and with the Russia and other powers not trying to encroach upon it? Do you think that was the real reason that they wanted a stranglehold on this region?
I'm sorry.
It's really hard to understand you. It was in the last one as well. So basically, are you saying that was it about the protecting the route to India?
Basically,
right? Does it think it was the route to protect?
British were trying to protect
what,
India.
What was part of the impetus of the mandate in order to secure what eggheads in my department call imperial communications, which basically means keeping the access contiguous. Absolutely. The reason for these places having the emphasis that they did was twofold. One was for the resources themselves, and then how they played into the broader colonial project. Absolutely, the biggest priority was the Suez Canal. And in fact, the decision-making that went to who should be where they are had to do with the strategic ideas of who best could go ahead and secure that. Was that something that was a function of racism? I think it would be certainly impossible to deny that. The British felt much more comfortable with the British Zionist establishment than they did with the Arab communities of the region. They were used to dealing with them. I mean, people like Weizmann, people like Rothschild were very close to people like Lloyd George, Balfour as well. In fact, Balfour's district, constituency from where he sat, was Weizmann's district. So he knew him from Manchester from long before. That familiarity, that comfort played a big role in then the maintenance of the mandate of Palestine as it was. And then, of course, also of oil. That kind of protectiveness and need to contain the contiguity of the empire was vital. But it's also important to remember that part of that urge was because the British wanted to keep the French out. And the French were there because they did have investment in the infrastructure dating back to the mid-19th century. And the British also recognized during World War I not only that stake that the French had in the region, but they also did feel badly that, unlike Great Britain, France was actually the locus of the war. There were no trenches dug in England. There was no mustard gas that was deployed in England. That was all happening in France. The British knew that the French were going to rightly demand reparations, and the British wanted to make sure they got them. They just weren't going to give them any from their own empire.
Thank you.
You got a question here at the front. It's like deja vu. These are the same questions from the last session. Same people. Is anybody else here?
Maybe we didn't give them the right answer last time.
Yeah.
Now, you've got two key words up there. Mandate and Palestine. And I'm reeling at the moment in a lot of pain seeing what's happening in Palestine. What's the connection?
Oh, God. I thought we'd done that.
Between them and then.
Between the
then
Mandate and Palestine, or
Mandate, Palestine, and what's going on at present.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the 4.5 hour minutes that we have remaining, I could probably do you more justice by recommending some books. I think that you have some incredible scholarship that has been done. We mentioned Eugene Rogan, who is going to be here next weekend at the festival, is one of the foremost experts on the Middle East. His current book on 1860, Massacre of Damascus, his other book of the fall of the Ottomans is also.
I was going to say the fall, you're completely correct. If you're really lazy, well, this is a bit of a, you know, I don't get any money from any of this because somebody will have stolen all my films and put them on YouTube. But the projects I made for the BBC, so I've got, there's one called The Ottomans, a three-part series called The Ottomans, Europe's Muslim Emperors. I think if you watch that series, it's all about the Ottoman Empire, and the final episode is all about the collapse of the Ottoman Empire and the world that it creates.
Yeah. Very closely to the Seven Pearls of Wisdom. Written by
T.E. Lawrence.
T.E. Lawrence,
exactly. Yeah. Well, Lawrence then, in Seven Pearls of Wisdom, I mean, he realized that even he was kept in the dark on so much of this. I would recommend people like Ilan Pape,
yeah.
Avi Schleim, who've done excellent work, David Fromkin's
What's the woman who wrote the incredible book on the Ottomans?
Caroline Finkel?
Caroline Finkel, yeah.
Yeah.
I know her work's been people have updated some of the things, but Caroline Finkel's work on, I think it's Osman's Dream. Her book is a really good one. But like I said, if you're very, very lazy, just go on YouTube and watch The Ottomans, Europe's Muslim Emperors.
Also, a book called Blood and Sand. Name of the author escapes me right now. But what he shows, I mean, I think it's very easy to put this completely on sinister intent. But what you find in many of these situations is that paranoia almost takes on a momentum of its own when it comes to how history then develops.
So we've got time for another question.
We've got a question.
There's one person there.
Hello. What was the British financial and political gain from propelling Zionism?
Oh, what was the British financial situation? So there's a couple of things I think that we can go ahead and verify. One is that the British war effort was being underwritten by the Rothschild banking family and institutions of the sort. And so that created proximity of interaction. That, of course, like we find in politics today, leads to having a certain level of influence. And if you have that much face time, I suppose, you can then also go ahead and put forth an agenda. Agendas, like anything else when it comes to politics, are a quid pro quo. There was no Arab representation in London that really could match that, either in the resources or even in the proximity. But again, it's not the only factor that was there. On a more charitable day, I will look at this period of history. And it's like somebody who's in high school who's running for student government. They will go ahead and promise everything to everybody because they want to get elected. They don't necessarily pay attention to the fact that some of what they're promising might be diametrically opposed to what they promised somebody else. And at this time, under war circumstances, and it was a totalistic war, and there certainly was no guarantee of victory. And let's face it, the war didn't really end with a decisive defeat. It ended with a ceasefire. It ended with an armistice, not a surrender. So that's how close the situation was. I think that for the British, they threw out all of these promises and pledges, and they said, we'll defer worrying about what happens afterwards. Because remember, I mean, these were only going to matter if they won. Unfortunately, for the destinies of many people, I suppose, they did win. And I'm not saying that in a really negative way, but then the British had to confront, how do we reconcile all these promises and pledges? And that wasn't done in a very pretty or delicate way.
Any more questions?
There's
one there just in front. Then that's it, I think, yeah.
Just a quick question. I've heard the Zionists were offered Uganda. Is that true?
I'm sorry?
I've been hearing that the Zionists were offered Uganda as a homeland. Is that a true thing?
So, I mean, This is a kind of a side thing. In 1897, there was the World Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, where the idea of linking Zionism, which had been an aspirational movement, which then turned into a European nationalist movement, gained greater currency of saying it should be in Palestine, because that's the only area by which there is some kind of ancestral connection. Other ideas that were being thrown around, including South America, yeah. East Africa, and all. But the idea of then trying to court the Jewish community behind this idea was not going to have the same success. We have to remember that even the project of Zionism into the 1920s and 30s, after the establishment of the mandate, was not something that was a majority opinion, even within the Jewish community or the Jewish diaspora.
So it's less about being offered and more about one of the countries under consideration for settlement, as opposed to being offered a country and saying, that's yours. Yeah.
After World War II, was it even thought of?
Sorry, you can't hear you.
After World War II, was a part of Germany ever considered?
No.
No.
Never heard anything.
Germany was never... No. Considered part of the calculus.
They caused the...
But the honest thing to say is, actually, without going down a rabbit hole, by the time you get to the end of the Second World War, it's too late. Yeah. We're talking about significant numbers. You're talking about cities, communities existing in what is now what becomes the modern-day state of Israel. It's not a case of, like, what can happen afterwards. Yeah. It's too late. It's already happened.
Right. I mean,
Tel Aviv, all these places exist.
One or two generations in.
Yeah. I mean, people have been coming from the 1880s and in large numbers in the 1920s and 30s. Communities have been built, businesses have been built, an embryonic state in apparatus exists, a military wings exist. It's not about could it be in Germany, it's not of interest by then, because a state was already in existence.
Yeah. Already momentum there then. The momentum was there.
Sorry, I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, actually.
I can't hear you, but what I should say is we should finish now anyway.
Yeah, we do have to clear.
So can I just say a show of hand appreciation for Saeed?
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.